The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Years ago, I read that certain Native American communities held their most sacred objects in common, but that many of them were passed on temporarily into the keeping of one person or another in the community, that it was an honor to be asked to be the keeper of the object for a while. And you knew also that in time, there would come the moment when you too would need to pass it on to someone else for the honor and the responsibility of keeping it. Never, though, was ownership in question. The objects were beyond ownership, like everything else of greatest value: nation, earth, air. So one Sunday, I started an experiment. I bought a silk tie, the most beautiful, luxurious one I could find, and I brought a hand-woven scarf I had fallen in love with in India and waited to give as a gift to someone, but not yet given away. And I wrapped them up, and I wrote up some rules. You had to wear it at least twice in the intervening week. And if someone complimented you or asked you about it, you had to explain what we were in the midst of as an experiment in our community. And the next week, you needed to bring the gift wrapped again, as it had been for you, in paper or in a beautiful bag to give to someone else in the community during worship with the same instructions. The whole effort, of course, was trying to uproot the notion of ownership, to see how it felt to do this countercultural thing. Could something be lovely and just in your hands for a short while? Was ownership a healthy idea? Was it true that something in common would not be treated well? The same purported truth or lore that's being used, I think, right now to dismantle the commons of government or justify it, of education, of healthcare, of protection and care for the natural world and parks. Is private ownership the best way to care for common goods? I think we know the answer. Privatization in a capitalist economy is about extraction, profit, return on investment. Clear-cutting old redwood forests is likely profitable. But the loss of a mature ecosystem and the severing of the lungs of the land is a loss to the common good for private gain. There's no larger wisdom that plays out in that kind of math. Robin Wall Kimmerer, the professor of botany, the writer we heard from this morning, member of the Potawatomi Nation, which is one of the Anishinaabe peoples of the Great Lakes region, in her newest book, The Serviceberry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World, she uses the serviceberry to bring us back to the truths about how we're meant to be in relationship to resources, to each other, and to life. The economy that nature teaches us. Kimmerer begins her reflection when her neighbors, Polly and Ed Drexler, the ones to whom she dedicates the book, invite her over to come pick berries on their property. The Drexlers had planted serviceberries in their small working farm, but locals aren't yet aware of the deliciousness of the serviceberry, and the harvest is huge, and so Polly and Ed do well, what the berry does, they give away what they have profligately. Putting the berries in her mouth and in her bucket, Kimmer reflects, you could call them natural resources or ecosystem services, but the robins and I know them as gifts. We both sing gratitude with our mouths full. The botanist professor in Kimmerer points out to the reader that service berries actually have a lot of different names. Saskatoon, Juneberry, Shadbush, Shadblow, Sugarplum, Sarvis. Ethnobotanists, she writes, know that the more names a plant has, the greater is its cultural importance. This tree, it's beloved for its fruits, for its medicinal use, and for the early froth of flowers that whiten the woodland edges at the hint, the first hint of spring, she writes. Service berry, she tells us, is known as a calendar plant. So faithful is it to the seasonal weather patterns. Its bloom is a sign that the ground has thawed. In this folklore, this was the time that the mountain roads became passable for circuit preachers who arrived to lead church services. It's also a reliable indicator to fisher folks that the shad are running upstream. Buried in the language of her people, Kimmerer shows us also a deeper understanding of this berry and how it orients us and our place in the world. The word in Potawatomi, she says, for service berries is bozekmin. It's a superlative. It means the best of the berries. Tasting one, she agrees. But she reflects the word bozekmin has in its root the word min, the phrase min, a root word for berry in her language. Strawberry, raspberry, even the word for apple actually has min in the name. But min, she also tells us, is also the root for the word gift. Anishinaabe linguist James Vukelich writes, these plants are a manifestation of unconditional love that plants have for people. Plants offer whatever they have to whoever needs it, he writes. Seeing and naming them as gifts, literally naming them as gifts, changes things a bit. In the Anishinaabe world, in fact, everything is understood as a gift in the natural world. Quote, when we speak of these things, we don't speak of them as natural resources or commodities, Kimmerer writes. Our whole relationship to the natural world changes because of that. We enter the world not of economic exchange, not transactions, but a gift economy. This is a world where one receives generously and then feels intuitively gratitude, is moved immediately to the joy of sharing and reciprocity, not as some ritual of manners, Kimmerer writes, but as a recognition of how your life is contingent on the life of another in a huge web of belonging and service. Websites and apps where we take what's extra that we have and rather than sell it, we give it away to whoever needs it, to spare the earth, an additional extraction, to bless others with our abundance, to stop treating everything as disposable because somehow that doesn't sit right with us, hurts our souls. It shows up when we bring a neighbor a meal because we hear they're sick, and they share the lemons on their tree, and we pull out their garbage cans when we notice they've overslept. We know this economy of gifts and belonging, don't we? And that's not minor, Kimmerer writes, because, quote, what we crave is not trickle-down, faceless profits, but reciprocal face-to-face relationships, which are naturally abundant but made scarce in the anonymity of large-scale economics. We want flow and a sense that we're caught in this web of enough, can trust one another and hold one another. Not that we need to amass and hoard so much, build walls, be like that cartoon character. Do you remember him? He was like, mine, 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 mine. I'm the wealthy miser. Does anyone remember this cartoon character? Oh my God, he lives in my head sometimes. We want to be alive and in motion, don't we? Like that sweet berry she describes, all of them, that fruit that feeds whoever needs to be fed and trusts that their seeds will get spread and that the ground will be nourished again with rain and sun and by other plants and animals, interconnected and generative and generous and abundant in motion. What most of us really want, she says, is a sense of belonging and relationship and purpose and beauty, which can never be commoditized. I want to be part of a system, she says, in which wealth means having enough to share, and where the currency of exchange is gratitude and the infinite renewable resource of kindness, which multiplies every time it's shared rather than depreciating with use. What if, Kimmerer writes, what if scarcity is a cultural construct, a fiction that fences us off from a better way of life? And protecting ours and letting others suffer. It makes no sense, not logically and not in the language of the heart and the soul or whatever you want to call that deepest part of ourselves. The service berry gives it away every year. But it's a hard way to live in our world. So I want to confess something. I prepared myself. I realized that this year there was so much fear and so much, I'm going to try not to cry, so much, I'm going to think about baseball as I say this, so much fear and so much anxiety with prices going high and the world off its rocker, at least our part of the world especially, that people would constrict. And even though that this is just when we needed to stay together and connected, that I was ready to love all of us through this time, that I would understand if we got protective and scared and tight. Why wouldn't we? And I went away for a week last week on vacation, and I came back ready to hold what would feel hard. And I was wrong. Because when I came back, I found out that among other things, the pledges that had come in the week while I was gone, that they made our pledge levels higher in the number of pledges received than the previous year when everything was rosy. And that though we asked people to give 5 or 10% more, that the increase was closer to 17 or 20%? I am 30 years in the ministry, in some very healthy congregations with very generous people, and I have never seen that happen. And visitors are pledging, a dozen of you, more than a dozen of you, who are just visiting, have pledged. And please don't get me wrong, we have a long way to go. You'll hear a little more from Harry and Miriam. And those who haven't given, I suppose you could really mess this up. And that would stink. But I am holding so much joy and hope that we are refusing to be the worst of what the world is baiting us to be. And I want to thank you for that. And in the midst of it all, Oriana boldly stood up and she talked as an eighth grader, right? She's an eighth grade, ninth grade, tenth grader, ninth grade. Still, you know, a young person. About period poverty, and some of you were so moved because it was so courageous to talk about something that's been, well, a taboo subject. And we raised $1,300 that week when we were asking you to pledge. And it isn't just money. Look around, keep your eyes open. It's everywhere. This is the gift economy, a piece of it. You all, you give your time and your talents and your treasures every week. That's how this place works. In the language and the flow of gifts. Can we imagine a human economy with the currency which emulates the flow from Mother Earth? Kimmerer writes, a currency of gifts. I think we can. In Sacred Economics, Charles Eisenstein reflects on ecosystems and writes, in nature, headlong growth and all-out competition are features of immature ecosystems, followed by complex interdependency, symbiosis, cooperation, and the cycling of resources. The next stage of the human economy will parallel what we are beginning to understand about nature. It will call forth the gifts of each of us. It will emphasize cooperation over competition. It will encourage circulation over hoarding, and it will be cyclical, not linear. Money may not disappear anytime soon, he writes, but it will serve a diminished role even as it takes on more of the properties of the gift. The economy will shrink and our lives will grow. Thank you all for the safe harbor that we make together. Our gifts of self and trust in shared ventures and the beauty and power of what is held in common for a world of trust and gratitude and reciprocity and flow. And before I end, I want to tell one more story. You know that experiment of the tie and the scarf? Well, shortly into it, a woman made an appointment to see me. We'd recently done the memorial service of her teenage daughter who had died. The girl's two best friends had flanked the mother like a protective guard that day in an image I will never get out of my head. The mother said she'd made three infinity scarves that winter out of the softest wool for the three girls, but she'd never had a chance to give them before her daughter died, and that week she'd given her daughter's friends theirs. But she had this third one, her daughter's, and it felt so sacred, and it felt meant to be used. And she asked if we could put that scarf into circulation too, that whoever needed to feel loved or warm or cared for could keep it for a while and then bring it back. It would be held in common, it would be shared, she said. As you said, the most sacred things are. It would be a gift in motion, blessing the world, as her daughter had been. May we live in the truth of the gift economy. Generous, trusting, profligate, like the service berry offering itself to whoever needs it, like the best of our own lives, like the best of what we make together, rich in gratitude, in reciprocity, in mutual care and responsibility. What if scarcity is just a cultural construct, Kimmerer asks, a fiction that fences us off from a better way of life? What if? Thank you all. I love you. Bless you. Amen. Each week this month, we have had one or two or sometimes multiple little people last week share reflections on their time at UUSF and what they love. And today, it's David Jones.
I first walked into this place in 1975. I had just come from Brigham Young University at Provo, Utah. Needless to say, it was quite a shock. But I found out quickly I could be myself here. I kept coming. In 77, I joined the choir. And Alex Post was director as well as organist. It was a wonderful experience, and it was meeting almost all of my needs, my musical needs. Later on, I helped start the Bell Choir, and I have been playing with it off and on for about 20 years. So going back a little more to 1978, I met the love of my life, Donald Williams. We started dating. I brought him here first for a service in 1980. And he was hooked. I mean, it was wonderful experience. And then we kept coming week after week. They were printing the sermons at that time, so we made sure that we got copies of the sermons and we could read them during the week. So in 1981, we both joined. We decided to become members of this church. And as Don used to say, it's payback time. It's you know, we're taking in all of this wonderful stuff here, but we're not giving back. And he thought that was important. He got involved in the board. We were here a few years, and then suddenly we moved away for 12 years. We needed to buy property, and we couldn't afford it here, so we moved to Petaluma and commuted for 12 years, every morning, five times a week, to work here. That was that was tiring enough. We moved back in 1997. I got involved on the board. I was on the board from 2000 to 2006. I believe I'm the only member of this church to have married the same man three times. Unless there's, I want to give you a chance to raise your hand if you have any. Okay. The first time was in 2000. We wanted a church wedding. We invited people from the Santa Rosa Fellowship, where we were members when we lived up there, to come down here for the service. And I think there are about 400 people total who came to the wedding in 2000. The Reverend Margot Campbell Gross, our minister emerita, married us, and what many of you may not know is she, as an act of social justice, would not sign the marriage certificate. I thought that was really commendable of her, and I've never forgotten that. I just think it's really wonderful to make that kind of a stand. So we had never thought about doing another wedding, and then 2004 came and Gavin Newsom opened up the wedding doors, and we said, oh yes, we've got to do this. So it was like a Wednesday, we made the decision, and then we went down to City Hall on a Thursday and just did it. And that was a lot of fun, but it turned out to be not so happy in the long run because we ended up in a privileged class of people who were allowed to stay married when they closed the doors on everyone else. So that was not very happy, but then, you know, the act of the Supreme Court in 2008 came along, and we got married a third time in City Hall with the Reverend Greg Stewart performing the ceremony. So those are the three times. wouldn't really change anything at all. I think one of the areas of support that I want to acknowledge now is during the time when Don's body was sort of failing, giving out, and I was caregiver for him, starting in 2016, I said, oh, I can do this by myself. And eventually it got to be too much. And so we sold the condo and I moved into assisted living and I got him connected with hospice, which turned out to be a lifesaver for me as well as an easier passing for him. What I want to bring out here is that what I didn't expect to happen was to getting all the love and support from this congregation during that period and afterwards. It was really overwhelming. I can't stress to you, I hope many of you get to experience something like that. And I think in a funny way, maybe it's karma or what, I think getting involved in this church enables a lot of payback to happen in the way of emotional support and making friends. I wouldn't trade any of that for the whole world. Thank you.
I also don't know if you and Don started the Easter bonnets, or you just, yes. So in a few weeks, when Easter comes and we lay out a table of bonnets, and you're welcome to bring your own, that is something that Don and David started, that it carries on the joy, the frivolity of our Easter bonnet tradition, among other things. Let's take a moment to greet one another.
Enormous Panuco River by cramming into one of the many tiny wooden ferries that shuttled people and their wares back and forth. The little vessels wobbled frighteningly in the water. But my uncle's house in La Ribera was a short stroll from a saltwater lake that was flanked by sand dunes, on the other side of which was the Gulf of Mexico. I took the ferry. One afternoon, as I was sunning myself like a lizard atop my favorite wooden pier on the lake, I saw my father's Lincoln Town Car lumbering down the dirt path that led to my uncle's house. My vacation was over. he'd come to take me home. Fortunately, he planned to stay a few extra days to visit his old friends, local fishermen who had lived in La Ribera for generations. I tagged along. I loved the way my father and his friends lit up when they saw each other. As they reminisced about their adventures in the water, I was struck by how the weather played a role in their stories. Another common theme was the number of fish they were catching and how it compared to other years. The ebb and flow of the catch was a factor in taking care not to overfish the lake. It occurred to me that the extensive knowledge that the fishermen had didn't come from scientific methods, but from their relationship with the lake. Here, feast or famine, the lake and the people were symbiotic, sharing a history and a destiny. On one of the last days in La Ribera, my father and I went fishing with his friends. We set out on skiffs and stayed on the lake for hours. Ironically, I was the only one who caught a fish that whole day. It was late afternoon, but before heading back, the fishermen decided to make a special stopover. They maneuvered the skiffs through tributaries that led deep into the jungle. I was surprised when we reached our destination, a muddy bank in the middle of nowhere. We disembarked and anchored our skiffs. Then, one by one, the men headed into the jungle, disappearing into the green as if they were being swallowed. My father and I followed them into the thicket. We worked our way toward a dense strand of bushes and crawled inside. I couldn't believe my eyes. The men had tunneled into the bushes and made a fishing camp. The walls were green and alive, and the place pristine and thoughtfully organized. They had everything they could possibly need, sleeping mats, blankets, all sorts of gear. In one corner lay a fishing net someone had been repairing. They lit kerosene lanterns that they had placed throughout the shelter, filling it with a cozy golden glow. It was magical. Night was starting to fall, so we left the fishing camp. The stars above the lake came alive in the darkening sky as we headed back to the village. We took our time. I noticed some man-made lights in the far distance, and I asked about them. The fishermen told me that it was a construction project. They were building a bridge from Tampico to La Ribera. They became animated, talking excitedly about the progress and the economic possibilities the bridge would bring to their hamlet. They thought it was great. The wind coming off the gulf kicked up, and I felt a chill.